This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new film, Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, is a comedy about a hip-hop boy band. The film also satirizes music documentaries. It stars my guests, Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, and Akiva Schaffer, who also co-wrote the film. Taconi and Schaffer directed it. They play the members of a trio called the Style Boys that breaks up acrimoniously when Samberg's character, Connor, decides to go solo. Connor, who calls himself Connor for real, expects to become an even bigger star on his own, but things don't work out that way. Taconi's character stays with Connor, becoming his totally marginalized DJ. Schaffer's character leaves the music world, angry and bitter, and becomes a farmer. Samberg, Taconi, and Schaffer have been friends since junior high. The three of them joined Saturday Night Live together in 2005, Samberg as a cast member, and Taconi and Schaffer as writers and directors. Together, they all made the Saturday Night Live digital shorts that parodied hip-hop videos. As a trio, they work under the name The Lonely Island. Let's start with a song from Pop Star, one of the first songs Connor for Real releases as a solo artist, in which he brags about how humble he is. It's sung by Andy Samberg.
Y'all ready for this?
Watch out! Watch out! I'm a superstar, I kick down the door. Got the money and the bills, and I'm also so humble.
I'm so humble.
I'm so humble. I'm so humble.
Number one at the top of the humble list. My apple crumble is by far the most crumblest. But I act like it tastes bad out of humbleness. The thing about me that's so impressive is how infrequently I mention all of my successes. I poo-poo it when girls say that I should model. My belly's full from all the pride I swallow. I'm the most courteous, biddable, hospitable, reverential, normalary, Arnold Schwarzeneggerary. I hate compliments, put them in the mortuary. I'm so ordinary that it's truly quite extraordinary.
It's not a competition, but I'm winning. You won't hear me admit it, because I'm so timid and submissive. I treat five people like they're within. Talk simple for the dumb boys. I'm so
normal definition of a rock star.
Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, Akiva Schaffer, welcome to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back on the show. So the movie is about three guys in a boy band kind of group, and Andy's character goes solo and becomes the breakout star, leaving the other two behind. And so, I mean, it's a very funny setup, but you guys have actually been working together since junior high school. And once you all got to Saturday Night Live, it was Andy who was the one who was on the air. I know you were all in some of the shorts, but Andy was like the breakout star. So are you working out real anxieties in this movie?
This is our therapy on a grand scale.
It's a really expensive therapy.
So the name of your band in the movie is The Style Boys. Boys with a Z, of course.
Naturally, of course.
Did you have to come up with something so you could do a plural that ended with a Z instead of an S? It seems like an important an important part of a band name.
You know, it just works out that way.
It just,
when it's the right name, it just happens to have a Z at the end.
There's definitely a list of potential group names in a Google Doc somewhere, and I think they probably all ended in a Z.
And when Andy's character, Connor, goes solo, he's Connor for real with the number four, which is another, like, important thing to have. The number four.
Important.
Yeah.
We, in fact, didn't realize that so many people actually are their first name for real on, like, Instagram and stuff.
Is that really true? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Jeremy Renner is Renner for real, I know.
Kevin Hart is something.
Kevin Hart, I think, is Kevin Hart for real. But it's not directed at them. We thought of the name before we knew that.
the character is so much into being earnest on social media and sharing everything with his fans that we did think his name should feel like a social media handle.
Right. And also be about how real he is.
Yeah, exactly. How earnest and real he is. And also that his real name is Connor Freel. So we wanted...
That's a joke that you don't really catch in the movie unless you notice his mother's name. It says Tilly Friel is underneath Joan Cusack, but you really have to put it together. It's not something we hang a lantern on.
But right. Not anymore, because now we set it on Fresh Air and everyone will know.
Oh, yep. There you go. So as part of my preparation to do this interview, yes. I watched some of the Justin Bieber documentary.
Sure.
Wow.
As yes. I wanted to get deeply into this. and I watched...
You watched the first one.
The first one.
Bieber?
Yeah. And you have some direct quotes from it. Because there's the scene where he's this little child, and there's like a home movie of him playing drums. Because he gets drums when he's a kid. And then there's the scene where he's kind of keeping it real after he's becoming a star by going home and hanging out with his like boyhood friends. And you've got that scene.
Although they all have that, I will say. That was something we noticed through the One Direction one. They all go back to their home. Even Katy Perry, she goes to her grandma's house in Vegas. We noticed that was a staple of the popumentary, the visit back home. Mm-hmm. And it is often where you really start to love the character in any of those movies, where you go, oh, Katy's, she's just a normal girl from a hometown. Or, oh, One Direction boys, he used to work at that bakery. I do like Harry. It's endearing. Effective.
Akiva, I know when you were young, you were pretty obsessed with rock videos. Are there other things that you went back and looked at before co-directing this movie because you wanted to get that look, or you wanted to just like, you know, refer to it in some way to look authentic?
I mean, we all did together. We all watched a lot of what we've already covered. I would say our favorite was actually the One Direction This Is Us movie. That one's directed by Morgan Spurlock.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The director of like Super Size Me. It's really pretty well put together and entertaining. And it works. Like, we didn't know anything about those kids. And then we left being like, wow, these guys are great.
Yeah.
Like, it truly worked on us. Did the Bieber one kind of work on you? I mean, it worked on us. We were like, oh, my God, like, he's really talented.
Yes, he looks really talented. But also, like, I can't pretend like I've followed Justin Bieber's career carefully. So it's interesting to see the person emerge from the things that you just read in the headlines.
Exactly.
So, and you see like, oh, he was a boy. Like he,
he
was just
like
a kid who wanted
everybody.
To be a star like so many kids do, except he was talented and it was that whole YouTube thing. So it was actually kind of interesting. Yeah.
And people say this all the time, but it's really true. If you filmed like us when we were 17, 18, 19, we would be embarrassing ourselves every day. It would have been terrible. Like, I understand why he might have some what would be called bad behavior, because what 16-year-old
doesn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you go through any of that yourself? Like, when you went on Saturday Night Live, did the attention and stardom of it, especially for you, Andy, since you were on camera more, did it ever, like, knock you off balance?
A little bit. Again, it was... the sort of, I'm trying to think of a less annoying word than blessing, but the blessing of getting hired with two of my best friends and having that be something that allowed us to keep each other grounded through the whole process when it was really good and when it was really bad, to be like, oh, right, we knew each other before all this. We know who we are before all this. And it's really fun and cool that all this stuff is happening, but it's not necessarily going to change who we are.
And we were 26.
Yeah, we were a little older, too, so we knew who we were.
I mean, but one of the advantages of SNL, too, is that because it's happening every week, no matter whether you felt like you had been successful the week before or you had failed the week before in terms of what we were putting out there, because we made a short basically every week that we were there, there was another one the next week, so we couldn't really dwell on anything, really. I mean, like, there was obviously, like, moments of, like, oh, my God, like, people are really seeing the stuff that we're making, and excitement in that way, but we were just head down working so much that we couldn't really focus on much more than that.
Can we just talk about one more staple of the kind of boy band type documentary, and that is interviewing the preteen and young teen fans, the girls who are going like, oh, I want to marry him.
Yeah.
I want him to kiss me, you know, all that stuff. I'm wondering, like, as boys, how you related to that when you were deep into music and there was that whole, like, I have a crush on him side.
Like when we were in elementary school and all the girls were in love with New Kids on the Block?
Yes,
kind of thing.
Precisely.
I think as boys, you immediately hate those bands and are very...
it was a mix, though, because I really wanted to be them pretty badly, too.
Yes, that's true.
Like, you would watch New Kids on the Block. And, your outward reaction is like, those guys are stupid, their music sucks, because you're so jealous. But inwardly, I think I personally was like, oh, I would want to be them.
My experience was slightly different because I have two older sisters, and we all shared one bedroom for a really long time. So I grew up with, like, Teen Beat and Bop magazine pinups of all those dudes all over my bedroom wall, essentially, because of that. So, like, there was a lot of, like, Corey Haim, Corey Feldman, and Kirk Cameron, and New Kids on the Block, and even, like, New Edition, and Bobby Brown, and all that stuff. So it was more normal to me because I didn't know anything else until I got my own room.
And then what did you put on the wall?
Mark McGuire and Jose Canseco. Oh, yeah, the Bash Brothers. Before we knew they were on the juice.
I had a Paula Abdul poster, too.
Yeah, we like Paula Abdul.
And a Janet Jackson. Mm-hmm. Those were the kind of the equivalent.
That was one of the first concerts that me and Keith went to together was Paula Abdul, actually.
Did you want to be in real bands before you decided to be in, like, funny bands, to do, like, satirical music?
Not really. No. I was doing jokey rap stuff in high school, but it was never serious. It was always like, it'd be cool to do this as a form of comedy.
Yeah, you said we've been working together since junior high, but I would not consider what we were doing together as working. We were more just drinking and skateboarding.
And studying.
And doing graffiti, but yes. And studying.
But we were not in the theater program or anything. We were not ambitious. We did not have goals. We weren't in high school being like, when we graduate, we're going to be in show business. We were just kids who liked comedy and we liked music and we were nerds about that stuff. We were the kids that would go out of our way to find the new, you know, the new song, the new record at Amoeba or whatever.
That's all true. But some of us were in the theater programs, though, too.
Yeah, Yorm was in the theater program.
Some of us were really
cool theater. We were all making stuff.
In high school?
Yeah, we just didn't think of it as being ambitious. We were doing it for fun. Like, you guys used to do little audio sketches that you would play for us. We were all shooting stuff on our home video cameras and doing, like, in-camera editing of sketches and weird ideas we had. We were just loving doing it. So it wasn't like, I'm going to leverage this into a career. It was like, you know what would be fun to do is get together with our friends and goof around and make stuff.
So let's play another song from the soundtrack of Pop Star. And because there are words in the song that you can't say on radio, we're going to play a clean version of the song. The song is called Finest Girl, parentheses, the Bin Laden song. It's got a catchy hook, which I can't really say. but let's hear it. Enjoy.
Freak when she started talking. She said, me like we've been Laden. That girl was a freak. She said she wanted me to harder than the military. Bin Laden. Bin Laden. Bin Laden. She wanted a harder than the U.S. government. Bin Laden.
She was a freaky kind of girl. Kept up on current events from all around the world. More specifically, one event. The time Osama bin Laden got shot in the head. She said, do me like that, but I couldn't track the metaphor. That said, I can see you horny like a stegosaur. That said again, your request is so irregular. She put on a beard, I started looking at the exit door. Then a turban, then a tunic. She said, invade my cave with your special unit. I said he wasn't in a cave, but there was no stopping. She demanded that I like we bin Laden.
Bin Laden. I just can't imagine how you came up with the hook for that. Like, what made you think of the premise of this song?
Just lightning strikes and inspires you, you know?
I will say, in the movie, he puts out a new record. It flops, and people think it's kind of an offensive record and don't think it's good. And that gave us, in the writing process, a lot of freedom to come up with songs that we thought, let's make the silliest version of a song that fails. That gives you so much creative license to make the silliest song you can think of because it's not supposed to be quote-unquote good.
Yeah, a lot of the time the stuff we make that people like the most is delivered via an untrustworthy narrator. A lot of the songs in the movie are that way because this is a guy who's kind of spiraling and has lost touch with what is actually okay to say and not.
Exactly.
Right.
But I don't know how we came up with that one specifically.
I think it was just someone randomly said, what if it was that? And then we're like, oh.
I mean, there's a lot of bad sex metaphor R&B songs out there. This one's just one degree crazier than someone would probably do.
Which one of you is going to claim responsibility for the line "Invade my cave with your special unit"?
We want to say that.
I don't know. We definitely just went through the whole real thing and just tried to think of all the worst analogies and stuff.
My favorite thing about that line is that then in the story of the song, my character corrects her and says he wasn't in a cave.
Yeah, I know. I love somehow, that.
Somehow he becomes more informed
to be up on current events too. Yeah.
But like, there was no stopping.
I know that.
So Yorma, you do like the beats, right?
No, not so much anymore. Like on our first album and all of our first stuff that was like, you know, just that we were making together when we first got to LA and we're living in a house together, I made all that early stuff. But as we've progressed, I will say, and have gone more of like official sounding, which is part of our joke, honestly, is like making it sound like it's big current pop sounding stuff and current sounding rap beats, which is something I cannot do as well. And I really don't have time as much anymore. But also I'm not good enough. Our stuff is meant to sound really clean and
we do what big real rappers do, and we call up our label and say, hey, call up all the producers who are out there trying to make beats and have them all submit stuff to us.
So is that the way it works now, that you just have like auditions for beats?
Yeah, essentially. We get sent hundreds of them. From producers who are unknown all the way up to producers who are pretty known. Because a lot of guys and girls out there that are producing beats, they'll have made one in the hopes that it's for Drake, and then Drake doesn't use it, and now it's just sitting on their hard drive, and then they're like, oh, well, listen to this one. And then we listen to it and go, wow, that sounds like a Drake song. What if we made some terrible jokes on top of it and just ruined it? And I think they're happy to sell it to us because it's just sitting on their hard drive. Any producer wakes up every day and makes, you know, a bunch of beats, so they all have kind of stuff sitting around.
So when it comes to figuring out the rhymes, I mean, you know, these are like comic rhymes that you're doing, but there's still some pretty intricate rhyme schemes in them. So are you using any other person's rap as a template for the rhyme scheme, or are you just like coming up with it as an original?
It's original.
Original, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're holding ourselves to a higher standard than, there's no direct parody. Our whole thing always has been to try to not direct parody any single person or group out there, just to try to take the general vibe we're feeling on the radio or in a certain genre of song or a trope we've noticed, and then just create a completely new original song that kind of reminds you of the other stuff.
We always say we're not real rappers because sometimes people go like, hey, it sounds really real. You guys are like real rappers. And we're like, no, we're much worse than any real rapper. But when it comes to fake rappers, or frappers, as we call it, I would contest we are actually the best. Yeah. We're the best fake rappers out there.
Do you have a favorite complicated rhyme you've come up with that you're especially proud of?
There's some good ones Andy came up with for the I'm So Humble.
Oh, yeah. Feel more humble than Dikembe Mutombo after a stumble left him covered in a big pot of gumbo.
There you go. That
good.
Counts.
that's some good fake rap.
Andy, you have to do a lot of, you know, like hip-hop choreography in the film. Did you have a choreographer?
We had a choreographer for the dancers. There's a lot of big stage numbers. For the most part, I was winging it.
Seriously?
Yeah, but luckily I didn't have to really fall in step that often. We tried to really distract you from the fact that I was just kind of holding a microphone and goofing around, because the dancers were incredible. And I think, you know, there's some of that in the documentaries we watched, where it's hard to perform, you know, vocals and also be doing a ton of dance choreography. It makes people like Beyonce that much more impressive.
Yeah, and I never know how they do that without like heaving and getting out of breath.
I definitely did heave and get out of breath quite a bit, yeah.
So, Andy, one of the things that you do, which, like, everybody does, like, even women performers do this now, it's kind of swipe at your crotch with one hand.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if there's an official name for that move. It used to be more like crotch grabbing, but now it's more like swiping.
Yeah. Yes.
So,
and sometimes you go two hands, and, you know, I mean, they switch it up.
And we have some crotch-centric lyrics, so
always
that makes sense.
We always
and
have.
You're just feeling the rhythmo, you know?
I was feeling the rhythmo, yeah.
So some of the songs in here are hilarious because they're written to be songs performed by somebody who doesn't realize they're bad. He thinks they're great, and he thinks these songs are going to be huge hits. And they're awful, and the lyrics are politically incorrect, and just like, but they're hilarious, unintentionally for him. They're hilarious. And a great example of that is the Equal Rights song. So do you want to talk a little bit about that song, and then we'll hear it?
Sure. It was... The idea behind it is sort of, you know, talking about how a lot of times people will try and piggyback a social cause to leverage goodwill. And in this case, it's my character, Connor's, attempting to piggyback the gay marriage cause and really get behind it. But he has trouble wrapping his head around what he really is saying. And maybe is not as behind it as he claims to be.
And he's unaware that it's legal in most places in America as well.
Yes.
So he's the gay marriage is legal now, yeah.
Right. So he's behind the curve.
He's a step behind.
Yeah.
And then he finds it difficult, grappling with the fact that if the wrong person heard the song, they might think he was gay, and he hasn't quite learned how to grapple with that yet, so he's constantly making a disclaimer that he himself is not gay, but he's just making the song.
Yeah, we kind of imagined it being as his character heard the Macklemore and Ryan Lewis song and was like, ooh, I want to do that too, but then my guy gets it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
He's not as evolved as he thinks he is.
So this is Equal Rights from the soundtrack of Popstar.
Featuring Pink.
Yes, featuring Pink.
Discrimination. It ain't right. I'm not gay, but if I was, I would want equal rights. I'm not gay, but if I were, I would marry who I like. It's not fair, I'm not gay, that the government has to say in who can love who not gay, or to which god you can pray on a gay. It gets me so angry, on behalf of them, I feel passionate, not gay. So I pray for them, and I say for them, we need to make a change, not gay. I see it clear as day, this area is not great titties. We need equality, and for all to see that this is the new way. Not gay, it just seems not gay, wrong, not gay, that no one seems to care. Sports, we can't continue to pretend this not gay madness has to end. Not gay.
I was born this way.
Straight.
You were born your way.
Gay.
Gay or straight, straight or gay, it's all okay.
Sure.
It's time to make a change.
Yes.
It's time to stop the hate. Who you are is beautiful.
Not gay. We can't live this way.
So that's Andy Samberg and Pink from the soundtrack of the new music comedy Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping, which stars Andy Samberg and was co-written by Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, and Akiva Schaffer. And Yorma and Akiva co-directed the movie as well. And together, the three of them are Lonely Island, who did all those great digital shorts, the music parodies for Saturday Night Live. There's a great proposal scene where Andy, your character, proposes to his actress girlfriend, and it's all to get good press because he's in the middle of a bad press cycle and he wants to like change the media cycle. So there's like, you know, photographers there. And so you're in like your white tuxedo and you get down on one knee and you're kind of kneeling in front of her and you open up the box with the ring in it and she gets this like delighted look on her face and does that like fluttering of the hands to like indicate delight. And there is an ad. Do you have like taxi TV where you live? Where like you're in a taxi and they show little videos.
Well, we were like, just in New York for 2 weeks, so we saw a lot of it there.
Yeah, so they show like highlights of like things that have been on NBC and highlights of like other shows and then ads. And there's a jewelry ad. And this company kind of advertises itself. It's like the place where people come when they're going to propose. Mm-hmm. And I swear it's exactly the same. The same shot. He's on his knees. He opens the box. She kind of flutters her hands in delight. It's just like note for note. So
in the ad in the taxi, is there a wolf attack that happens?
No,
right
no, there's not the wolf attack.
Okay, so it's slightly different.
Slightly different.
Yeah. But I were you going for like a specific scene in your mind when you did that?
Yeah, for that one, we were slightly inspired by, you know, Kanye West proposed quite publicly to Kim.
What was on the Kardashians show?
Yeah, it was on the reality show that they have.
There also was not a wolf attack in that one.
Yeah, that's the major difference in that. We just use things as a jumping off point for inspiration.
Okay, you guys brought up the wolf attack. I wasn't going to do it, but there is a wolf attack.
It's in one of the trailers. It's out there.
Yeah, it's already been ruined for people.
Because Seal is singing in this scene, and his singing sets off the wolves, kind of like my singing sets off my cat, except it doesn't end nearly as badly for me as it does for Seal. But I was sure you must be like quoting a movie there that I hadn't seen, because I was sure it was like a quote. So did you have a specific movie in mind? Where
just we were just going for what this guy would do.
Okay,
you put it, he's trying to reset the media cycle. He knows that the things people love are like weddings and babies and things like that. And so he reaches out to his girlfriend to propose very publicly, to just make a scene.
So this might be too personal, but can I ask you each how you decided to get married, if you went down on your knee and proposed or did something like more informal?
Keeve, you were just shooting jump shots at the basketball court, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I told her, if I make this half court one, then I'm gonna put a ring on that. And of course I sunk it, because I'm great at basketball.
Sorry, Yoram, what were you saying?
No. Mine was real, and I much prefer what was just being said about Akiva. I kind of blew my proposal, honestly. I took my wife to the beach in Alameda, California, which is not a nice beach at all. It was raining. And the worst part was, though, I think the entire time that we were driving to the beach, she knew I was going to do it, and I did too. And I think like we were both like kind of horrified that this was happening.
Well, horrified at what?
I don't know. Just that we were really doing, like, we've been together for 8 years at that point, and the fact that it was real was like, really, I probably shouldn't be telling this story.
This is not a romantic story.
No, it was like
not a romantic story.
Mine also is not.
I felt
romantic.
Like I blew it, honestly. Like, kind of.
I think Andy's like the only one, but I don't know if he wants to tell it on the radio.
Mine was perfect and magical. Yeah. I'll say that. She didn't know it was going to happen. We were in a beautiful place that was very special to both of us. I was by a fire pit with like a glowing amber light. I got down on one knee. Like, the stuff I said was perfect. I can't tell you how great it went.
All right, and I believe it, because I was at your wedding, and your wedding was also
truly the most magical vow ever. So,
yes.
I really got to bring it. My wife is a poet, so if I'm half-assing it, then it's going to be pretty
Andy,
clear.
Andy, you nailed it.
So how have the three of you managed to stay together for so long?
Well, you know what? It's all about
the
honesty,
most thing,
communication,
Keith.
And
keep it interesting in the bedroom.
The bedroom.
Yeah, you gotta.
You gotta.
Do what it takes.
And do we ever.
We just love working together. And we love being buddies. And when we work together, we get to stay buddies. So it's sort of a cyclical, wonderful thing.
And we've all worked with other people, and we love doing that too. But like, there's just something special that happens when we're all together.
How did you get hired as a trio, like all three of you on Saturday Night Live? That's probably unprecedented, right?
It was.
Yeah. We were told by our representation that, like, don't get your hopes up. They never hire three people at once. But when Andy got hired in the cast, then it kind of was only like they hired a writing team as opposed to a trio. And they usually have about one writing team at a time. And we got lucky that the last writing team, these guys, Sloven and Allen, had just left. And so there was kind of like a slot for a writing team.
They literally just put us into their office.
Yeah. We just got real lucky.
We got really, really lucky. Also, we had just worked on the MTV Movie Awards writing for Jimmy Fallon, who hosted that year. And Jimmy and two of SNL's producers, Steve Higgins and Mike Shoemaker, were all working on the Movie Awards together. And we had a really nice time with them. So they had seen the three of us working together and seen us, you know, as a unit. So I think the word got back to Lauren into the show that if you needed three folks, that these three have a good rapport. And we just kind of got lucky. Yeah, we submitted a writing packet that was the three of us as writers, and then it just worked out.
Was the understanding that you would be working on the digital shorts together, the music videos?
No,
we were just hired as a normal cast member and normal writers. And then, but we knew that we were best when we could shoot and edit something. And so we started maybe a few months into being there. We got some stuff on the live show, but we just kind of were like in our office going, wouldn't it be cool if we could, you know, do one of our shorts. So we just borrowed a camera from a film school because we didn't want to ask permission because then they could say no, or it could come out bad and we could embarrass ourselves. So we just kind of went off on our own, made a short film, and then just submitted it, just kind of showed it to the producers.
Yeah, Bill Hader's wife, Maggie, worked at a film school, and she would meet us at a subway station and hand us a camera that we could borrow. So the first couple of shorts were just made with a borrowed video camera, and then we would edit
it. It sounds very shady, like sort of like a...
It kind of was. She was checking out the camera from a film school.
Yeah, we weren't supposed to
get off to us.
So getting back to Saturday Night Live a second, how old were you, each of you, when you were allowed to stay up late enough to watch it? And who was on when you watched?
God, I would say is 13 probably around when we would start standing up at night? You had older siblings, so you might have done it earlier.
My story is different. I was 8, and I was really into WWF wrestling, and they had a show called Saturday Night's Main Event that was on once every 4 weeks, and I didn't know how to use the TV guide, so I never knew which week it was going to be on. And I would sneak past my parents' bedroom, they didn't know I was awake, and sneak into our TV room and turn it on really low volume. And every week it wasn't on, it was SNL. So I accidentally started watching SNL, and it was the Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, John Lovitz, Jan Hooks era.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the same era for us as well. That's amazing, by the way. I don't know if I'd heard that story before.
So when you all left Saturday Night Live, were you able to watch the show afterwards, or did you feel like, I'm not on it anymore, and it's just too painful to watch?
I still watch every episode.
Oh, no, yeah, we're big fans.
Because I would imagine feeling very ambivalent about leaving because it looks like it's so much fun to be on it. So it might be hard to watch it when you left because part of you maybe still wished you were there.
The first episode after I left was really hard because it was a great episode. It was when Seth MacFarlane hosted the season premiere. And Bill had that like puppet class sketch, and there was a ton of stuff on it where I was like, oh no, SNL's the best. Why did I leave? But it was time. We had to go. So
why was it time? Why did you know you had to go?
You just reach a moment where you can't mentally and physically deal with it anymore. It's really, really grueling. And as much as you understand how much your life has improved because of working there and how you have a career because you've worked there and how much you love working there and love the people who work there, you can't physically get it up to like do it anymore. It just hurts too bad. You don't feel the joy in your heart about doing it the same way. And once that goes away, it doesn't lead to good work.
Did all that adrenaline take a toll on your bodies?
Yes.
Yeah, at the time.
Hard to know. Hard to know because we didn't do it any other way.
We'll find out when we croak early.
It's addictive, though. Anybody who works there would say it's addictive. There's nowhere else where you know, like, for instance, we made this movie. We started writing 2.5 years ago, and through shooting it, editing it, and getting it done, it'll be 2.5 years before you honestly get to hear people like laugh at the jokes. And there you come up with something on Friday, or even if it's just a joke written into a sketch, you come up with it at 6 p.m. on Saturday.
Yeah.
Or between dress and air, you could add a new joke. So at 11 p.m., you could be like, what if he said this instead of this? And then at 11:45, it's on national television.
Yeah.
And there's very few places that, besides all the like late night daily talk shows, where you can get that kind of instant.
But even those pre-tapes.
Yeah, it's addictive in that way. It's really fun.
Well, Yorma, just minutes before you came to the studio for our interview, you sent us this great short bumper that you made.
We just thought that your show maybe could use a little bit of a spice, maybe.
A little Lonely Island pizzazz.
Yeah, and these are not just for today. These are for other episodes. I would actually say more so than even today. These are for you to use. I mean,
they're called drops. They're like a lot of other radio shows have these where they'll shout out the name of like the show and, you know, like who's on it. And they play them randomly just to give you like a station ID thing. And I think it's really helpful for you to have one just so like during an interview, you could play this at any time you're interviewing, you know. Hey, you're interviewing Barack Obama. You could just play it in the middle of what he's talking
about. Head of a state or something.
So here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to compare how I typically introduce myself to how you're introducing me. Typically, I'd say, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's your version.
That's nice.
You're listening to the Demented Mind of Terry Gross. 60 minutes of poignant questions with Terry Gross. She's not a game.
Sixty minutes of poignant questions with Terry Gross.
It's over 60 minutes too, usually.
Oh my god!
Yeah, that was a Funk Master Flex
doing
your drop. That was the Funk Flex, Funk Master Flex, legendary.
We grew
City
up
DJ.
Listening to that guy, and to have him on your drop is, I think, very.
It's a big honor for you, Terry.
It's a huge honor. Let's explain. Yeah, we need to explain how much of an honor it is and how
a
honored
legend
you should feel.
Dropping for a legend.
Yeah, it's a perfect match, actually.
Well, people need to know that you have a demented mind.
Should I know who the rapper is who you just mentioned?
He's a DJ, a very famous DJ in New York City called Funkmaster Flex.
Okay.
Like, famous for 30 years, I would say, at this point, or 20 years at least.
And he organized, like, really legendary mixtape stuff and records. And
he was kind of an institution in New York.
He also did a mixtape that we all bought in high school that was actually on record. It was on vinyl, called 60 Minutes of Funk. So he's actually referencing his own.
Oh,
his own thing.
Yeah.
But he doesn't do 60 Minutes of Poignant Questions. That's just me.
No, he doesn't.
That's just me.
No, I mean, he might. But I think that's more your bag.
Yeah.
No, that's, yeah, he's giving it up. He's letting you have that territory.
Right,
that real estate.
Right. As he should. I want to thank you guys. It's been great to talk with you again. I love talking with you. It was really fun. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure.
We look very forward to having everyone in Berkeley say they heard this and respect us a little bit more.
Andy Samberg, Yorma Taconi, and Akiva Schaffer co-wrote and star in the new film comedy Pop Star Never Stop Never Stopping. Taconi and Schaffer co-wrote the film. The film opens Friday, and the soundtrack will be released then, too. Next to
a girl. True love trumps all predator. Flying kicks, not gay. Big watch, not gay. Missionary, one love. Gym socks, nunchuck, and not gay. Light of fluid, HD, ninja world, peace, four-wheel drive. Gay marriage, love, beef. Tree love, golf club, two guys. Not gay, rainbow muff dive. Harvey Milk, Sean Penn, not gay. Drum solo, courtside seat, safe sex. One-arm push-ups, Leonard, Skinnerd. I'm not gay, I'm not gay. I'm not gay. I'm not gay.
I was born this way.
I'm straight.
You were born your way.
And now it's time for sexual freedom for all. Sexual freedom for all. Sexual freedom for all. Sexual freedom for all. Not gay.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews the new album by the klezmer fusion band Naftule's Dream. This is Fresh Air.